You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great week. I'm still thinking about that Oprah interview with Meghan and Harry, and I'm sure that you are too. Made me think about what it must really be like to be a royal. So I found this list of protocols that one has to agree to in order to be a royal. So if you're going to marry a royal, you have to know this. So I want you to ask yourself if you would be willing to stay the course given these protocols. For example, when the queen stands, so do you. And when greeting the queen, men are expected to bow their heads and women are expected to curtsy. I don't know. You're thinking to yourself, sure, why not? I could do that. But I mean, every time you see her, let's say you have spent a weekend at that castle of hers. Every time she walks in the room, you got to do the same thing. I think you'd get kind of annoyed. At some point, you're going to be like, listen, lady, all due respect, my back hurts. Okay. Like, do we have to keep doing this? Also, members of the royal family are expected to dress modestly and never overtly casual. So you're thinking to yourself, modestly, sure, I don't have to have a dress on where my tits are hanging out. But that means never wearing joggers. And that's even in your house by yourself. You're not allowed to wear casual clothing. And after the year that we've had, can you agree that everybody needs a good pair of joggers? A respectable all-black outfit is always packed whenever they travel in case of a sudden death where they must attend a funeral. A little bit of a buzzkill. I mean, you know, think about all the stuff you have to pack for a vacation anyway. You got to throw in some funeral clothes. I don't know, kind of a buzzkill. Royalty are expected to be addressed by their full given names rather than nicknames given to them by their families. So, for example, when she married William, Kate began being referred to as Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge. I am also a Catherine. I forget it's my name. Somebody says Catherine, I'm like, who the hell are you talking about? Now, if somebody says Kathy, I want to stab them, but I've always been Katie or Kate. So it would throw me off to be an adult and have to go by the name that my mother gave me. So a little bit of a hiccup. Don't understand why Harry got through the cracks, but you can't have a nickname. No member of the royal family is supposed to sign autographs or take a selfie with a fan. I mean, that's a little awkward. You know, someone's losing their mind when they meet you. They're crying. You can't throw them a bone and just take a picture with them. That seems a little ridiculous. Okay, it's recommended that royals avoid public displays of affection as much as possible. I don't know. You just want to like hold someone's hand, give them a little kiss. I don't know. Pretend that you like them. No, you can't do any of it, which is why William and Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, never hold hands in public, which I just think is weird. Like, don't you want people to know that you like each other? All right. They must accept all gifts graciously. That would be hard for me. That would be hard for me because let somebody gave you like a really ugly poster, you know, a poster of yourself framed. Like, ooh, how do you accept that? Like, oh, thanks. I think it's a little weird. Okay. must get approval before a marriage proposal from the queen. So you've got to go to the grandmother and ask her if it's okay to propose to your girlfriend. Oh, I don't know, a little outdated. Members of the royal family are not allowed to vote or even publicly express their opinion on political matters. Okay, give me a break. You can't vote? Oh, no. You can't vote? I don't think so. Think of all the people that you hate in your life that just talk about their political views all the time on Facebook. I know. I get what you're saying. You're like, I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing that you don't have to hear about someone's politics. But not being able to vote? Forget it. No way. No freaking way. Okay, if you see Her Majesty move her purse from her left arm to her right arm, it's a signal to stop talking to her. So you imagine yourself, you're in the middle of a really great story, and then she moves her purse to the other arm, and you're just supposed to shut up? Like, no, I'll finish talking when I want to talk, okay? Now, when the queen finishes eating, so must you. I don't know, what if you really are into your nachos? What if you really like your quesadilla? What if you really like your chopped chicken salad? She stops eating, you stop eating? I think it's a little bit weird. Wedding dresses must be approved by the queen. So you're letting someone who's about 100 years old help you decide what to wear. This is like a nightmare episode of Say Yes to the Dress. And you can't speak without permission. So you can't do a media interview without getting okay and going over the bullet points beforehand. I mean, that's like a little bit ridiculous. Now, because Meghan Markle said she was silenced by the royals, everyone in my world was given a very clear directive from the moment the world knew that Harry and I were dating to always say no comment. Sometimes you don't want to say no comment. Sometimes you want to go, okay, well, that's ridiculous. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. So think about all of those things. If you're asking yourself, I don't know, is it so bad to live in a cottage, you know, in the English countryside that you don't have to pay the bills for? No, maybe not. Not so bad. You get a butler. Pretty sweet. But then again, all of that stuff comes with it. So something to think about this weekend. I have started watching The Real World Homecoming. You guys, I have cried my face off. So after first debuting in 1992, The Real World New York cast reuniting 30 years later for this Paramount Plus limited series. It's called The Real World Homecoming New York. So it's Becky, Andre, Heather B., Julie, Norman, Eric, and Kevin Powell. And they're continuing with MTV's social experiment by moving back in together into the same loft to have their lives taped as they reflect on past iconic moments and create all new ones. It is fantastic. I mean, just the first episode, they have each roommate come up to the door and they play back the moment that they walked into the door 30 years ago. There's an incredible moment in the first episode at the end where Kevin is talking to Julie's daughter over Facebook. I cried my face off. I realized that the thing that I love most about the show is it reminded me so much of going to Milton Hershey, you know, being dropped off by my mom at 14 and having her drive away and then graduating from school, having lived with so many different kinds of classmates. And really, I believe you can learn the most by living with someone. And so I love watching the show because you can see that the person that walked into that loft 30 years ago became a totally different person by the time they left. So I recommend that. It's on Paramount Plus, but you can also watch it on YouTube. This episode I'm so excited about. Shep Rose is a cast member on Bravo's Southern Charm and the author of the new book, Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar. You guys, it's a great book. He is a great, great writer. I'm telling you, it's a great read. It talks about his wild stories from traveling, becoming a TV personality. And in the book, he talks about his favorite movies and books. And as I was reading it, I realized that we like so many of the same things. So I was super amped to talk to him about it. And in the episode, we compare notes. So I will put out a list of all the books and the movies we talked about just in case you're listening to the episode and you're like, oh God, I want to go see that movie or I want to go read that book. And I also asked choreographer Liana Marie Alvarez to review On Point on Disney Plus. It's a 6-part docuseries that follows students and captures a season in the School of American Ballet in New York City. I know very little about the ballet world, so I wanted to ask her about how accurate this docuseries is. It's an inside look at the most elite ballet program in the country. And then you get to see how they prepare every year for the Nutcracker. It's really, really cool. If your kids love to dance, I highly recommend it. So here we go. Shep Rose from Southern Charm, author of the new book, Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar. I was treated by getting an advanced copy of the book and wrote to you immediately. Shep, this book is so freaking good, and you're a great, great writer. First of all, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's good to see you. I think you're a great, great interviewer. So I remember the first time we talked, God, how long ago was that? Probably 4 or 5 years ago. You asked me some like really specific questions that I was surprised that you knew, like about Episcopal, where I went to high school and all this stuff. I was like, oh, wow, she did her homework. So, so kudos to you as well. But thank you so much. It means a lot. And I really appreciate you reaching out and telling me that that you liked it and you thought I might have a little future in the writing business. I hope that's true.
I've actually been telling people, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, I really think that if you wrote fiction, you could be the next Pat Conroy.
We'll see. I would need like, I mean, I'm not going to downplay how much help I had, meaning I tell people I gave as much clay, you know, to mold as I possibly could. And I had people helping sculpt it into a book. So I got to, especially Dina, she was extremely helpful. Dina Gatchman was extremely helpful. So I don't know if I have like the patience or the organizational skills to write a novel on my own, but I appreciate the vote of confidence.
Well, maybe if you just had some help with it. I think you're a great storyteller. I was surprised to hear, not surprised to hear you're most enthusiastic in elementary school. Surprised to hear that you were kicked out of boarding school.
Yeah.
What, tell everybody what the hell happened.
Well, I hope I'm not kind of retreading in the book what I said, but it basically you're 15, you're 14, 15 years old, and they send you to a school and put you with other 14, 15, 16 year olds and then give you a million rules to follow. And you're like, okay. By the way, every kid there is kind of there, by the way, their friends are at home, just getting new cars and going to beer bashes. And so it's kind of a mind fuck, honestly, a little bit. And it's sort of like you can't control the uncontrollable, and hormonal kids, are going to do crazy fun things and try to get away with stuff. And I was just on the forefront of that. I mean, we would go, I mean, I got kicked out for an accumulation of like four or five things. And finally they were like, we have to let you go. It was like getting fired. the dean of students was like, we don't dislike you, Shep. Like you just are having too much fun.
Yeah.
And so there's a marijuana offense and the other, a bunch of stuff. Like I would sign my leave. You had to like get your parents to sign a leave of absence for you. And you would go and spend the night wherever. And they would like do the homework. I mean, it was pretty draconian on their part. I mean, they were like putting two and two together and trying to figure out where we were going when we would already, like, we were legally not bound to them. It was so messed up, in my opinion. And I mean, when you're 16, you're trying to, you know, find weed or something like that. And I mean, yeah. You know, and we would go smoke cigarettes at this place called The Wall. It was down by the center. And, you know, or we would go out into the woods and try to smoke cigarettes. I mean, I was just one of those kids. I guess no apologies on that, but that's just who I was. I was trying to always testing the fence kind of, right. You know, touching the stove, so to speak. Maybe that I should have called the books Touching the Stove.
So when your parents would get a phone call from you, what would they anticipate that phone call would be? Was it inevitably like, I think I'm really messed up, or you're not going to believe this hilarious story?
My mom always said, no news is good news with me. So if she doesn't hear anything, everything's good. But yeah, as soon as she hears my name or my voice on the phone, she tensed up.
Well, a good thing too is you tell a lot of stories about working, and you've had like every job that you can imagine, which by the way is nice to hear, because even though you grew up in privilege, like, you've had a ton of different jobs and have met people from across the country and the world, not just from working, but by life experience, which your father encouraged you to do because he had lived overseas. So he wanted you to be global citizens. How important has that been to who you are as a person?
I think it means everything. I think if you sent some of the people in this country who are narrow-minded or whatever you want to call them, I'm not going to get into mudslinging at this moment, but you sent them on a trip to Southeast Asia or to Argentina or Central America, their eyes would be way open to, real poverty. Real poverty and tough situations and places where there's no opportunity. Here in the U.S., they say that, the 1% or whatever. In those countries, there's no opportunity. U.S. is amazing, right? You do have the opportunity to become successful if you get lucky and you work hard. These places, that's not even an option. That doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
And that makes you more empathetic. And that makes you care more about the world. And I was in Dubai and I met these two Iranian girls, and they were amazing girls and so fun. And we just had so much fun together. And I would say your average guy and, an hour away from me, we're in Charleston right now, I'd say every Iranian is a terrorist, or something like that. They would have that opinion. And it's important to learn that that's not necessarily true, not even close. So there's good people everywhere. And that's kind of a good lesson to learn.
So you have been on 7 seasons of Southern Charm. How has that experience helped you be introspective, and what have you learned about yourself in the process? In other words, who were you when you first started filming? Because you tell a story about how you went Whitney, it was a rooftop. And that, you give them this card that says, go fuck yourself. And then you film the pilot at your farm. We know that that show was really in the beginning supposed to be about men doing bad things, right?
Yeah.
Bad behavior. And then over time, the show kind of changed, all of the women that were cast for the show. Who was Shep Rose first season and who is Shep Rose now?
Gosh, I was so cocky back then. Probably that's the biggest difference. But I was also super hopeful. And I was like, I remember thinking, if Andy Cohen decided to, not do Watch What Happens, I could do that, And I was telling the production company, and they were like, no, you can't. And I couldn't. Probably, and I don't know. But I just had a lot of enthusiasm. I'm a little more cynical now, after 7 years of being on TV and not exactly sanguine, I guess, as I was in the beginning. So But that's good too. You learn these lessons and you get smacked down and it's, you really have to navigate some turbulent waters. And so I'm trying to be better at that. But you also, the tough part about the show is you have to be interesting and funny, but you got to try to not cross the line. You got to walk the razor's edge and for your own self-preservation, mostly because, as you know, they can take anything you say and make it a story, a plot point, so to speak. And that's fair game. I totally understand that. I would do the same thing if I was in the editing room or what have you. So you got to make sure you're like, I've definitely had like a season, I think season 6, I'm watching and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm the villain. I mean, to a certain degree, I hope watchers, viewers didn't think that 100%, but there, I was on the wrong side of some, and I was watching it happen in slow motion kind of, and I was, you know, it was horrifying.
Do you think your view on,
I'm too honest, honestly. I mean, I'll tell you exactly what I feel about, somebody, and to my detriment, probably. Yeah. I think a lot of some of the other people, but I also think that I hope that is endearing a little bit as well. I'm not trying to sculpt or mold an image for myself. I really am not. What you see is 100% what you get.
You told a story in it that I don't know that I had ever heard, that Craig sent away a blank application or made it seem like he was sending paperwork off.
Yes.
In an attempt to make it seem like he had a shit together.
Yes. That was either season 2 or 3. And he like stamped a fake envelope, like all this stuff. And I sat there and watched him. I mean, he's come a long way, and I'm happy for him. But yeah, in the beginning, he was just like a wreck. I mean, we all are wrecks, but he was lying a lot. And now he owns his weirdness, and good for him. And and good things are happening to him. And So it's nice to see. But those first few years, he was floundering. And but again, none of us really have our shit together, or otherwise it wouldn't be a show.
So when you sometimes see back the show, do you ever have a moment where you're like, that does not reflect who I am or what I think, and maybe I need to step away?
Yeah, I think that all the time. And so, yeah, I've had a lot of fun, and I have fun filming it. It's just, it's 3.5 months, and it's a lot of fun, and all these parties are planned, but the fallout when the season drops, that's when you're the most nervous, because you don't know what everyone else is talking about. All you know is the things that you said. And so you got to try to not say anything too inflammatory, but then again, you have to be interesting, and you have to be honest and as provocative as you can. Because I do care about the show. I want it to be good, you know? So I definitely get embroiled in some things, and I'd rather not, but this season Taylor helped tremendously. She's right over here. she helped tremendously as sort of my life raft to get away from a lot of controversy. And I appreciate that.
But it's also probably hard because the experience is so unique. So if someone's outside of it, it was probably, I'm assuming, it'd be very hard for you to have friends outside of the show talk to you about what's going on within the show, because it's such a unique experience.
I know. And I'm like careful. Last night I had dinner with some friends from out of town, and I started to talk about the show, and I was like, wait, 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 wait. They probably don't want to hear this. And then they were like, no, no, we do. This is interesting. So I just assume nobody wants to talk about it. And I have certain friends who, when the show starts, are like, we'll see you on the other side, buddy. Have fun. Oh, you know, like,
yeah.
And so, yeah, that happens quite often.
Over time, you've said that, and I think this is unique to just you, but you've really maintained friendships with everybody that's been on the show.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And that's what the audience needs to understand. You know, like we all have love for each other because we're all feel like we've been in the foxhole together. We know things that nobody else in the world knows, maybe the Vanderpump people or, you know, the Real Housewives. But we've been in it together in the trenches, so to speak. So there is a closeness just for that, by that very token, right there. So, and you know, and I've said some things that I wish I hadn't, but, and people have said some things about me, but I'm very quick to forgive. Look, again, we are making a show. If you want to say something about me, make sure it's accurate first, but you think I'm an asshole? Say I'm an asshole. It's okay. I'll be okay. So I encourage people to say whatever you want on camera, just as long as it's accurate. You're not making up a lie about me.
Do you ever feel like you've gotten to a point where like I've outgrown the show? Like, you know, some of the cast is younger than you.
Yes. I mean, yeah, kind of, I do. But, you know, I don't want to sink the ship. Not saying I have that power, by the way. Right. I mean, but I don't, you know, a lot of people, I'm not doing it. I don't want it to end, but I wouldn't cry myself to sleep if it did. Right. Let's put it that way. And but a lot of people's livelihood have to do with the show, you know, and not only my cast members, but people up higher, you know. And so I don't want to kill it, but I get frustrated at times. And every season Cameron threatened to quit every single season, and she actually did last year. And I know that there was a lot of hand wringing. I'm sure there was, from people who have a stake in the show, and we managed to survive. And I've said it before, maybe one person is not bigger than the sum of the parts. And if anybody was, it was going to be Cameron, right? She was like the voice of reason or whatever. But yeah, I don't, you know, we haven't got an offer to do the next season yet. I'm pretty sure that will probably happen, and we'll see what I do. But again, I don't want to be the turd in the punch bowl. You know what I mean?
right. And then I kind of felt like that in the reunion watching you, like, I don't know, you weren't as, seemed a little bit elder statesman.
I was trying to, you know, I've got, those can be so incendiary, and I just was like, okay, you say what you need to say, but you don't have, you've done, I don't know. I had a nice season last year. I was like, don't blow it. You know, don't blow it at the reunion. Don't say anything stupid. And because unfortunately the audience, it's just the last thing you did. I mean, they forget your transgressions quite easily from one episode to the next, one season to the next, et cetera. So just don't keep it. So I don't know. Like, you're right. Like, I'd rather have like a bad four episodes at the beginning of a season than four ones at the end.
Now, when you meet Taylor's family, do you have to say, well, I've been on this television show, just heads up, if you want to watch the season with me, let's do it.
Yeah. No, they had friends that were fans of the show. So that was fun. I got to meet, we went up to Asheville, and Taylor's mom was like, okay, these are our great friends and they love the show. Let's go have a beer. I was like, I'd be happy to. So that was cool. But I think that they got a kick out of seeing their daughter on TV.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say. And everything kind of went rather smoothly in our little world. So there was no harm done.
This book is full of great stories. I love your affection for your parents. They seem great. One of the things that I love when you talk about your mother is her love of reading.
Yep.
And I was very surprised reading throughout the book how many things that we have in common. The books that we read, the movies we love, the TV shows we love, our sense of humor.
Good.
So I wanted to go through some of them. Okay.
Okay. Over Christmas, it was just me and my folks, my brother and sister with their in-laws. And every day we wake up and drink a little coffee and then get some lunch. And then all afternoon, the three of us would sit in the sitting room with a book and read. Yeah. For hours on end. And it was just, I looked around, I was like, this is nice. Yeah.
Yeah. That is cool. Okay. Let's go through some of the movies that made you cry. Okay. Number one, Field of Dreams. Holy shitballs. Me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My dad was never as into sports as I was very into sports. My parents they didn't really care that much. They were super into athletics. So they were into reading.
Have you ever seen Peggy Sue Got Married?
Yeah.
That reminds me of the Field of Dreams too. Just like the moment where she sees her grandmother and she's back in time. That's kind of similar. Okay. Number two for you is Terms of Endearment. Mm. Talk to me about that.
Look, if you had cancer anywhere in your family or whatever, which I have, I remember coming home from school when I was, I don't know, sixth grade or something. and my mom was just sobbing, crying. And I'd never seen her cry, really. You know, I had never seen her cry. And it was her brother, my uncle, oh, wow. who had just got diagnosed with leukemia. And it's just went through a whole thing there. I mean, when you're in sixth grade, fifth grade, you're kind of clueless, but you're picking things up, you know, and that was sort of an informative time in my life. And very sad to see my mom go through that and my aunts and uncles and grandparents. And he was the best guy. I mean, you know, only the good die young, obviously, like the Billy Joel song, but he was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. So very sad.
What was his name?
Dexter Hobbs.
Dexter Hobbs. Wow. Well,
yeah.
Put that in the queue for a baby name.
My mom's side of the family are the Hobbs. And my other uncle's name is Truman. So it's Truman and Dexter. Yeah.
There you go. There are sons' names for you.
Cool names. Yeah.
Number three, Gandhi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just love that movie. I love history. I love learning. But that movie is just, he's so amazing. What an amazing human being. Like, you know, it's his name is like a euphemism for like perfection, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, what do you think, I'm fucking Gandhi, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's something. He must have done something right, you know. Exactly. And then when he fasts the guys on both sides of the argument, the Muslims and the Hindus, are crying and begging him to eat. I mean, that's something. Mm-hmm.
That is something. Okay, number four, Lonesome Dove. Why is this not a shocker to me?
My mom made me read Lonesome Dove. Oh. She said it's her favorite book, and it was 900 pages. She goes, please. And I mean, I thank her for that immensely, because it's my favorite book too.
Oh, okay.
And the movie, of course, the movie is a miniseries movie with Ricky Schroeder.
Ricky Schroeder, my first crush. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So I thought that was really good. I think, you know, watching that, and then I think I read the book after I watched a little of that, and it's fun to put Tommy Lee Jones as that character, Robert Duvall. I mean, both wonderful actors, as you know, and it's great.
Okay, so two movies I wanted to see if you have watched, because I feel like we like the same things. Empire of the Sun.
I know. I love the band Empire of the Sun. No, I know what it is. It's the Spielberg movie with Christian Bale. I have not sat down and watched the whole thing, but I've seen pieces and parts. Why?
That is that's one of my favorite movies of all time. Also based on a book, based on a true story. That is something to put in the list.
Okay.
Must watch. Okay. This is the other one I wanted to know if you watch, and it's obscure, and it was made in 1983, but it used to play on TV all the time when we were kids. Which is disturbing. It was called Without a Trace, starring Judd Hirsch and Stockard Channing.
I didn't see that.
So it's based on the story of Eaton Patz, the boy that was abducted. So it's this little boy, Alex, that just disappears one day after he does. His parents let him walk to school and he disappears. Mm. So it's their relentless pursuit of what happened to him. Mm-hmm. And there's this moment at the end where he's found. And he's running down the street to his mother after he's been missing, and you just lose it. You lose
it. What's wrong with where he got kidnapped?
Yeah, it's like an amalgamation of like all these missing kids stories. Then you have a suggested reading list. Now, this is the part in the book where I was like screaming at the wall. I'm like, we read the same books. This is insane. So I wanted to go through the ones that we both love, and then I'm going to give you a couple. Okay. I must say, My Life as a Humble Comedy Legend, Martin Short is my hero.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He is so funny.
And I cried. I cried during that. Oh, I mean, and laughed my ass off. And I say in the book, I met him at this NBC upfronts in the Valley. We were at the Ritz-Carlton. I had my robe on because I just come from the pool. So it was pretty funny. And I just had to, it was him and Maya Rudolph. I think they did a show.
Oh, they did the variety show together. Yeah.
I didn't watch it. I think it got canceled, but I pulled him aside and just said how much I loved his book. And he was like, oh, thank you. Like, where are you from? I was like, Charleston. And I don't know what I said after that. I just somehow, at that point, you just want to sneak away. You're like, okay, I said what I needed to say. I can only screw this up from here on out.
Yeah. And also the story about losing his wife to cancer. Awful.
Too much. Yeah. Too much. Yeah. And how the lights went on and off.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, oh, shit. Like, he was like, you know, I don't believe in ghosts, but that something was something. Happened. Yeah. And how Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell were such, you know, good friends. They lived at that lake, too. And it's just really warm. It's just good to know, you know, these people that we idolize.
Right.
It's good to know how good to find out that they're actually good souls. You know what I mean?
And one of the books that you have listed is one of my favorites. It's called Live from New York, The Complete Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. Yep. I devoured that one too.
Me too.
The stories about Al Franken and their office. That is one of my favorites too. How many people have you suggested that book to?
A lot.
Outside of your book.
No, I have it. I keep giving it away. I buy it and then give it away and I never see it again. But another good one is These Guys Have All the Fun, and it's an oral history of ESPN.
Yes.
And I think that's fascinating too. So I love these oral histories. They're great because it's different narratives. It's different people, how they, you know, saw a certain situation. So it's not one-sided, you know. Yeah. you get all sides. And oh boy, do they tear down Lorne Michaels, or some people do in that book.
I know.
I mean, they're pretty rough on him. But
you can kind of imagine, though. It seems like a pot of egos and bitterness.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I don't envy his position at all. But I've gotten to go to Saturday Night Live a couple times and sit in his office and watch Saturday Night Live. There's a little sliding glass door, and it's pretty surreal. Yeah.
So cool. The Boys in the Boat, The True Story of the American Team's Epic Journey to Win the Gold at the 1936 Olympics. A must read.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a children's version too that I always give to little boys. Yeah. It's a good one.
How what do they do? Just knock down some of the words, or
They just kind of like take out some of the sophisticated language and so it's like half the size, but it's great. It's a good beat for boys.
See, and that I don't think I wrote about this, but I would have loved that as a summer reading book, but unfortunately they used to. I hear today, and you can obviously speak to this with the amount of children you've got running around, that you can be more selective in what you want to read for kids, because I hated some of the stuff they throw at us. I mean, Steinbeck's okay, but like, you know, I don't really care about The Pearl. I just don't, you know.
Moby Dick. Yeah.
Yeah. And All Quiet on the Western Front. Like, I'm sorry, I don't care, you know, like, give me something about sports or something. But that's what you do. You get someone enthusiastic about reading in any way you can, you know.
That's what my son's teacher always said, is that if you have trouble with the child reading, you just figure out what they like. So for my daughter, it was biographies. It was my son's sports. So
yeah. And for me, it was Calvin and Hobbes. Hobbes. I read every single comic strip of Calvin and Hobbes, and my mom loved it and cultivated it. And so anyway,
that's so cool. Okay. Snow Falling on Cedars. Of course. Yeah.
Wonderful book. Yeah. Well, my mom will just say, you have to read this. And she's 90% right most of the time. Yeah. She's terrible in movies. She made me go, she called me laughing. I was in college, I think. And you have got to go see this movie. I'll pay, you know, I'll send you the money and envelope. I said, what movie, mom? She said, Analyze This with De Niro and Billy Crystal. It's so dumb. I watched it. I was like, mom, it's so cheesy and stupid. Don't ever recommend a movie to me again.
My favorite book of all time, Prayer for Owen Meany, John Irving.
Yeah. Amazing. And I like all his stuff, and I've read almost all of it. I think Son of Circus is really good and weird, and it's based in India, and you feel like he kind of puts you there. And I like that. And there's this one called Water Method Man, which is pretty obscure, but I really liked it. So yeah, I've devoured all this stuff.
And then Prince of Tides by Pat Conroy.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just amazing. And I've read his other stuff. I just think that one stands alone. I don't think anyone should argue with that. I mean, some people say The Water Is Wide is wonderful. I thought The Great Santini was annoying. I thought the dad was obnoxious. I was like, guy's an asshole. So, but then Lords of Discipline was good, I must say. So, but no, Prince of Tides is just such a perfect novel. And the brother in that is just, when they rescue the dolphin and they put it back, you know, and then he basically gets shot and killed by like a military force. And it's just so amazing.
I'm telling you, you could be the next Pat Conroy. Okay, here are some books that I want you to read, and I can send you this list. I told you about Revenge, A Story of Hope by Laura Blumenfeld. That one is really good. That's a must. The Oral History of 9/11 by Gareth Graff is really good.
I will read that. I will read that.
Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. Have you read that?
Yes,
okay.
I have.
Okay.
But Simon and Schuster, or was it William Morris? They sent me a few books just to get an idea of writing styles and stuff like that. And I really like this girl named Sloane Crossley.
I know who that is.
And I was laughing out loud at her book, Look Alive Out There, I think is what it's called. And I just thought she had a wonderful writing style, almost like Sedaris or David Foster Wallace is my favorite author. But he's just so brilliant. But so.
Did you know that she's the muse for John Hughes for the Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Who was?
Sloane.
Oh, I didn't know.
The character of Sloane Peterson is because John Hughes was friends with her father.
Oh, I didn't know that at all. Yeah. That's wild. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The last one is called Prep by Curtis Sittenfeld. So it's basically like Catcher in the Rye, but a female version.
Okay.
So set at a boarding school. So I feel like that you will relate to a lot of the boarding school stories.
You got it. Yeah. You're giving me homework.
Yes. Homework indeed. Okay. So your book again is called Average Expectations. I highly recommend it. I always enjoy chatting with you. I will send you my list. And I appreciate the reading list. I think that's a great thing that you did with the book.
Good.
Tell everybody where they can find your book and where they can follow you.
Oh, no. You can find it at Barnes and Noble, you can listen to it. I read the whole thing in front of a microphone over a 3-day period, which was kind of fun. And so, like Apple, iTunes, you can find it anywhere, and it comes out next week. I think is the official day, March 16th.
Yes, so, I think that's right. Okay.
It will be shortly available once you listen to Kate's amazing podcast.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm so excited and glad to be here.
So the older students at the school have come to Manhattan from across the U.S. to train for professional careers in ballet, while the younger dancers commute to classes from around the greater New York City area and in some cases are selected for coveted roles in the holiday classic, The Nutcracker, and they're all in pursuit of a common dream. And as the school's chairman of the faculty, Kay Mazzo, notes in the first episode, some succeed and some don't, but if you say, that's all I can do in my life, I have to dance, you're in the right place. Give me some perspective on how elite this school is. How lucky are these students to participate in this program, and at what level are they performing at to be admitted?
Yeah, super lucky. This is almost like a pre-professional program, actually. And because it's related and associated with New York City Ballet, it gives them the opportunity to have an internship and get that moment to apply themselves to work towards that company itself and being a principal dancer. So it's great because they do get the same staff, which is a lot of the principal dancers of New York City Ballet. They come in, they watch, even the director comes in and watches, gives them some pointers in the couple of years that they are there in the program, and then eventually do get to like graduate into the next level, which is being invited into the company or maybe invited to a different company around the world, but at least they're getting that form of training that they need.
So a typical dancer begins dancing at what age?
Ooh, 3 years old.
Oh my gosh.
They definitely take a combination class of like tap and ballet. And then around, I would say 10 to 15 is when you kind of know where you're heading. If this is like a thing for you and that you continue from then on. Ballet is a little bit different than other genres because it's more structured. It's everything, you know, body types, which obviously it's a little bit more open these days, to the type of training that you get. So it's a little bit more invested with time and money.
What is the perfect body type for a ballet dancer?
It's between 5'2 to 5'3, ideally between 115 to maybe 120, which has definitely expanded even to up to like 5'6 now. The dancers, considering because a lot of the male leads are not as tall as you think they would be. So you have to make sure that the dancer's proportion to his height on point.
So again, you have to be between ideally 5'2 to 5'3. I mean, that is nuts. But then now because this push to have more, you know, body acceptance, they're willing to move the lever to 5'6. And then for gentlemen, young men, what is their ideal height?
They don't really get any taller than 5'7. They're actually very petite men. Depending how you see it. They even have weight structures for them too. So they also have to stay in a certain area, I would say, because they're a little bit more. So they're between 160 to, because you're talking about muscle mass too, to 200.
Oh,
so that would be a little bit less. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you have a child that's an extraordinary dancer and they are incredibly gifted, but they happen to be 5'8. Is it like, let's move on to volleyball?
No, because there is companies, or I should say there's other areas of dance that you can put your child into. I wouldn't say that maybe she might be a ballerina, but she can definitely be a dancer because there's always, you know, there is artists that are tall and need taller dancers as a backup. So you can come across that. That's not uncommon. You know, you have Sierra, you know, that famous singer, and she's 6-something.
Wow.
So think about it. She's not going to have very tiny little dancers as Shakira would have. She's 5'2". So she's not going to have anyone taller than her.
True. So legendary choreographer George Balanchine founded the school with the goal of creating an American ballet company. What is his reputation for those of, you know, like myself, who are unfamiliar with that ballet world? What was his reputation like?
He's a trendsetter, but definitely history in the books, a man who created something out of nothing. There's been so many performances, choreographies, plays, however you want to put it, that he has created that has never been done before. He is beyond his years. He is a man who's trained so many to be beautiful ballerinas. Till this day, people follow his work. They try to recreate his work. They teach his work. He is definitely what we like to call, what's the best word for that? A genius in his own manner. He is one that definitely can't be duplicated, is for sure, and one that will constantly, just as the Martha Graham for contemporary, it's a man of history. So there's definitely, that's what I would say the best way. If you look him up, it's incredible the steps that he has taken for the ballet world.
So for the students, what kind of commitment is required of the younger dancers and of the older dancers?
The older dancers, definitely if you're staying in the dormitory, especially on this program, you do dance every single day. There's a certain amount of hours you can put into the three for training, and then you can go into rehearsals between 2 to 3 hours again also. So for the younger ones, they're probably just going to school normally, and then after that, they would come 5 days a week and take their classes, depending on exactly what like the program is offering for them and what level they're actually in. So they would have normal point class, and then they would have normal ballet class, and then any strengthening or core exercises that will help them, or ankle, those type of things that we call. But besides that, so ideally every dancer should be there Monday through Friday.
And then there obviously coming from all over the country, if not the world. So what are the conditions like that they're, it's like a dorm, like a college dorm?
Yeah, definitely. Like a college, it's perfect. Actually, that's how to place it. It's definitely, it's a dorm, obviously a place in New York. They come definitely from all over. Some are, I wouldn't say funded, some are on scholarships. Some of the family members help with that. Others are just lucky enough to have a family that supports that. But yeah, basically that's where they live. They go to school online and then they go to dance at night.
How hard is it to get a job at the school as an instructor, as a teacher, as a, you know, a mentor?
A lot of them are professionals that were with New York City Ballet. So ideally that you would have to start from there, be part of a company dancer, and then from there have the right knowledge that you're able to implement into the students. So I would say it's kind of hard because you have to go through your whole career and then decide, okay, now I want to mentor kids because you no longer want to be part of the company for whatever reasons, whether it's injury or just you're not there anymore in that placement of life. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's a very easy job to get to.
How prestigious is it, or how coveted is a position or a spot as part of the Nutcracker for the little kids that get to participate? Is that something like, put it in your bucket list, like you can for the rest of your life say, I danced the Nutcracker?
Oh, 100%. And it's so exciting because every year, depending on their level, they get to do a new section of the Nutcracker. So you work your way towards till you're up to the highest part of the Nutcracker, whether you do become, you know, the snowflake or not. But it's just about graduating to the next part and the next part. And it's exciting to say that you are part of the New York City Nutcracker. Like, that's something that you can actually put on your resume because it's so prestigious, because it's so well known.
Now, for those that are in the later years of the older students, so 17, 18 years old, what is the pressure like when you start auditioning for theater companies? Is it a shoe-in for any theater company in the world? Is it easier for them to get into the New York City Ballet? What are the pressures like for those students?
No, the pressure is insane. I would say it's insane. There's a lot that you put on yourself just as dancers because you want to be perfect. You think of all the hours you put in, all the hard work you put in, and what am I going to get out of it? And then the moment that you go and audition or get recognized with New York City, obviously it feels like a weight has been lifted off your shoulders because you know that everything that you put in since you were little has like finally made it. There's been moments where you don't get it. You won't get into New York City. Yes, this program does help for you to have that step forward, but doesn't automatically mean that you're going to make it. They still have to see something within you. But with that being said, they still implement the right things for you so that if you are going to apply for a different audition for a different program, say like in Russia or something like that, that you, at least you go, you come with what you need. It's truly insane the amount of pressure you put on yourself, what your teachers put on you too. Not in a bad way. They just want the best for you. And what your family, because of everything they've invested, the money they've invested, the time they've invested, you know, you're buying point shoes almost like every week, three or four times. That's $80. Wow. Now multiply that. That's a lot of money. So there's a bit of pressure that you want to, you know, you want to make your parents proud and you want to become something. And that's how you're. And once you go into a company, then you finally make money, so that you're able to survive, you know, and pay your own bills. So it's a lot that comes with it.
And there's that sweet scene where the little girls are getting their point shoes. Talk about the significance of that.
It's like it's growing up. It's going to the next chapter. Once you finally feel like you made it. Like they give you those shoes, and it's like, okay, here we go. It's the beginning of a new chapter. It's as if you just turned 15 or you just turned 21. You're so excited for what it's bringing you. It's maturity. That's actually the best way, the word to put it. It's maturity. You finally matured your way to be able to get these pair of shoes and you get a certificate with it. Like it's just pure joy. Mm-hmm. It's happiness, honestly. That's what it comes down to.
So for you to watch a show like this, what kind of feelings come up? Because you've worked in the industry for so long, you are a dancer, does this, like, are part of it, do you get a little bit of anxiety? Like, I remember the feeling of that, or is it just sort of sweet, like a sweeter feeling, like an appreciation of the great talent of the dancers, or perhaps a little bit of both?
I would say more appreciation. I feel like they did a really good job in showing all parts of it. I think that people need to know how it goes, especially when the younger generation of just knowing like how it works with ballet. I also love that they showcase the stories behind it when it comes to the families, because I think we should know that too, you know, how much the families do put into the ballerinas. But I don't know. I was just so happy with the overall, just, there was no negativity. It does show like they do work hard. They are away from their families, you know, if you take that step. So I just, for me, I think it was just happy. I think they did a great job. If anything, I mean, even through the whole COVID thing, they were still pushing through and showing, you know, the show, and that felt that view too. So I just feel like they did a great job. I don't know. Yeah.
So my last question is, have you ever seen the movie Center Stage, and did you enjoy it or did you find it cringy?
Oh my God. That's hilarious that you say that. So when I was younger and when it first came out, of course, I feel like we all did. We, as dancers, we loved it. And then as we got older, we realized how bad it actually was, how bad the technique was, how everything, which then became cringy. It's almost like we're like, did we just watch this movie, or were we blind at that time? But I also think it's because of the age of like the time it came out, the year, that some of us younger ones who are older now and like working in the industry are like, I don't even know why they didn't even hire like a full on dancer. Not that she was a bad actress, but it was just so, it's just so bad. It actually really is genuinely not that great. But the movie itself was written like, not in a bad way. It was just the dancers itself didn't showcase the best way possible. So yes, I think at the end of result, it is kind of cringy.
So tell everybody where they can follow you.
Yeah, of course. You guys can find me on Instagram. My name is Liana_Marie_Alvarez. It's pretty easy to find. I know, Kate, you follow me. So if not, then you can also see me on Twitter on Dancer5678. Super simple. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
I want to thank my outstanding guests, Shep Rose and Liana Marie, and remind you guys, click subscribe and leave a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can join the Facebook group Reality Life with Kate Casey to talk about this episode. And I hope that you took a listen to my last episode with Amanda Knox. It's a must listen. Must listen. So jump in the Facebook group to talk about it. My Twitter is @KateCasey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is @KateCaseyCA, where you can find my list of must-watch shows and get clips of the episodes from each week. You can join my newsletter on What to Watch with Kate Casey. If you go to katecasey.substack.com, you can get that in your email box every Monday. And you can find me on Clubhouse. I've got a group called Watch with Kate Casey, and I'm also in the Club Bravo group. So you can join Clubhouse, jump in the rooms, and we can chat. I've got an ongoing room every week where we talk about both my episodes each week, so you can meet new friends and we can chat it up. So join. And also, I've got a Patreon page with bonus episodes I'm about to record with Shannon Govani, who is the Vanity Fair correspondent in Toronto and a royal expert. And we're going to go more in depth about what it's really like to be a royal and behind the scenes of the Meghan and Harry interview. So go to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. Cannot wait for next week. I've got on the queue Paige and Hannah from Summer House and Jenny McCarthy. So check back with you next week.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.